Got to get straight with this guy first. I'm Chico, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Before I get started, I want to thank the committee for the wonderful job that they're obviously going to do and have been doing all along to put this together. I mean, this is really a beautiful place and a lot of beautiful people attending this convention, and it's wonderful, wonderful that we're all sober. I know the hotel is happy about that. I always try to think of the right thing to say, and I always tell a story that has to do with thinking about the right thing to say, and I know some of you would be disappointed if I don't tell it, so I'll go ahead and tell it and get it out of the way. There was this family who lived out in the country, and they didn't have any indoor plumbing. They had an outhouse, and eventually they got some indoor plumbing, and it was brand new and wonderful, and the lady of the house couldn't wait to try it out. I mean, it was just great. They had just painted the seat nice and pretty and white. And she went in there to try it out, and she was just enjoying this modern luxury, and it was just wonderful, except that she sat there so long that when she started to get up, she found the seat was stuck to her. So this was kind of an embarrassing situation. They unbolted the seat, and they took her and the seat to the doctor because they didn't know what else to do, and brought her into the doctor's office, and she was just totally embarrassed. And in her embarrassment, she said to the doctor, "My God, have you ever seen anything like this?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, but I've never seen one framed." I heard another story about a fellow that he wanted to do the right thing, always tried to do the right thing all his life, and sometimes that doesn't work. And I know we find that out sometimes when we think we have the right answer for someone and we sponsor them and they just won't stay sober, and then they go back out another time and come back in and someone else sponsors them and they stay sober, right? And you kind of wonder, you know, what did I do wrong? And this fellow was a good guy, and he sang in a church choir and he worked hard and, you know, a good man. And one day he came to work and he had two black eyes. And his working partner said to him, "My goodness, what happened to you?" And he said, "Well, it's a long story. I was in church singing in the choir, and when we all stood up to sing, I noticed that the lady in front of me, that her dress was pinched in her behind. And I thought, gee, that's awfully uncomfortable. So I thought I'd do the right thing, and I'd help her, and I pulled the dress out." And she turned around and punched me in the eye. And he says, "Well, yeah, but what happened to the other eye?" "Well, I figured she didn't like it that way, so I put it back the way it was." Isn't this a great place? I mean, this place is fabulous. It really is. I mean, I have stayed at some really bad hotels, and I mean, this is a wonderful place, really coming up in the world. I know you guys have to. How many of you here have stayed in really bad hotels? Come on, give me a show of hands. I mean, more than 2 hours. Before I forget, I want to be sure to tell you that I'm a Puerto Rican with an Irish disease. Actually, I was born in the capital of Puerto Rico. That's New York City. I moved to Alexandria, Virginia with my parents when I was real young. I was probably about a year old. And the first time that I remember being different from anyone was when we were there. Because other than our family and the Spanish teacher or a few other people, most everyone there was not Hispanic. And when I didn't speak English until I went to school. So when we walked down the street and we spoke in Spanish, people would look at us because it was a novelty. And I felt different. And that's the first time that I felt like I didn't fit in, that I was somehow, you know, not adequate, not the same, not good enough. And I remember when I was about, 9 years old or so, and we go out for recess at school and play baseball, softball. And I was the kid that was always picked last. You know, when the two captains chose up sides, I was sort of the team liability, so they picked me last. Because the only time I ever got a hit was if the ball hit the bat first. And I got up to bat one day, and the ball hit the bat first, and I ran to first base, and I made it without stumbling or falling or anything else, and got there. And I looked at my teammates, and now they were kind of recovering from the shock. And I looked at their faces, and there was something there that scared me. They expected something from me. They expected me to go from first base to second base to third base to home plate. The first baseman still had the ball in his glove, and I knew that he did. I looked back at my teammates, and they were still expecting something, and I stepped off the base, and I pretended I didn't know he had the ball, and I let him tag me out because it seemed to be an easier, softer way. And in just that manner, I continued to get tagged out in the game of life for a lot of years thereafter. I had my first drink when I was 11. I started using drugs when I was 12. My father died when I was 13, and we moved to Puerto Rico. And I found out that in Puerto Rico, at least at that time, I don't know how it is today, but at that time, there didn't seem to be any requirements as to how old you had to be to go up to the bar and get something to drink. And so I found out that at the age of 13, I could walk into a bar and I could have a beer or whatever I wanted. And I began drinking on a regular basis about that time. We moved to West Palm Beach about a year later, and I discovered that I couldn't walk up to a bar and get a drink. But it didn't take me long to gravitate towards the area where I wanted to be, where I knew I would be able to get alcohol and drugs and you know, just kind of gravitated to that way of life. And right here in Palm Beach County, you could find me most any day of the week, and certainly on the weekends, standing on the corner somewhere around 3rd and Rosemary. I knew all the thieves, and I knew all the hookers. I knew all the dealers, and I knew what everybody did. I'm sure they're all still there, still doing it. You know, it's amazing. I know that the one guy's still doing it. I'm not going to say where he's at, but I know he's still dealing drugs, and he was dealing them when I was a teenager, and that was a long time ago. It's amazing how they never found out about him, isn't it? I started getting a lot of trouble about this time, and getting into trouble meant going to jail. In West Palm Beach at that time, there was one Spanish cop, and they kind of put him in charge of me. And one night I was standing out in front of a Blue Front barbecue, which used to be between 1st and 2nd Street on Rosemary Avenue. It used to be a little shack there. And I was standing out there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and this cop car stopped. And he got out, and he started talking to me. So I did what I always did when a cop car stopped. I looked at him, and I said, "No comprendo inglés." And I just kept shaking my head, and he was going through all this, you know. Are you, where do you live, you know, where do you live? No comprendo, you know. So I was kind of enjoying his routine, you know. And another cop car stopped. Guess who it was? And he was a sergeant. The Spanish cop gets out, and the other guy turns around and says, "I got this Puerto Rican kid here. I think he's drinking." And he looks underage to me. He doesn't speak any English. And the sergeant looked at me and looked at him and said, "Him? He speaks better English than you, don't you, Chico?" And I said, "That's right, man." I found out that policemen do not have a good sense of humor at times like that. But the other guy took care of it, the Spanish guy. He took me home, you know, and he thought it was funny. And that's one time I didn't get in trouble. But I did go to jail a lot. And one of the times that I went to jail. See, I saw this movie. Now, this is back in the 50s. I'm 53 years old, so I'll tell you that so you don't have to keep figuring while I'm talking, okay? I saw this movie in the mid-50s called The Wild One. I know some of you probably saw it on reruns. Some of you never even heard of it, you know, but it was Marlon Brando, you know, and the leather jacket, the motorcycles and all, and I thought, man, this is cool. Well, you know, I was drinking and drugging. I couldn't afford a motorcycle, but I did buy a jacket and pretended my motorcycle was in the shop, see? So there was a scene in the movie where the townspeople rough Marlon Brando up, you know, and he says to him, "My old man can hit harder than that." And I thought, that's it. That's the line. So the next time I went to jail, and they took me to the back for a little interrogation, I said, "My old man can hit harder than that." I was wrong. I didn't promptly admit it, but I was wrong. It was about that time, I guess I was about 15 or 16, it was about that time that I found out through experience the difference between needing a morning drink and wanting a morning drink. There wasn't a day during that period of time when I didn't drink or use drugs or both. Obviously, I wasn't too good at being employed. I mean, I did work once in a while, but a lot of the money that I got, I have to tell you, I got it from robbing people. I didn't believe in the breaking into people's houses and taking their personal things because it was a point of pride. You don't take things from people like that. But your money was a different story, see? And I carried a switchblade with a 6.5-inch blade, and I had a straight razor, and that's basically what I did. And I never bought anybody a drink unless I thought it was going to benefit me in some way. I'm not telling you that in boast. I'm just telling you that because it's part of my story, and that's the way that it was. I got married at the age of 18 to my first wife, and I've noticed in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we talk about marriage, it's almost always in plural. We had three kids in this marriage. And the best way I can typify what went on in this home was that I missed the first six Christmases in a row. Because I was out there doing my thing, doing what was really important. And they were probably just as happy because when I came home, if I wasn't too drunk to walk, I usually came home and started raising hell with everybody. And if I'd have walked you through my house, you would have found a bullet hole in a wall, and you would have seen a door jam that was hacked up with a machete one night, and, you know, broken furniture and, you know, pieces of glass in the walls from thrown ashtrays and all of these things that we do when we become totally insanely drunk and violent, because I was a violent drunk. So these kids grew up in a home with an alcoholic father, at least in their early years. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time on December the 5th of 1964. I mean, man, I was young then. It was unbelievable. Everybody looked real old then. They've looked younger since then, I've noticed. But, you know, I mean, I came to AA, and I think there was about five or six other people in AA that were under 30. I was 25, and this was in 1964, and you know, there just wasn't too many people like that. And when I see young people coming to AA today, I mean, I'm real glad that it's the way it is, because when I came in, almost always someone would say to me, "Are you looking for Alateen?" Or somebody else would say, "Kid, I spilled more booze, drank more booze than you spilled, you know," and this type of thing like that. And there'd always be one little old lady what would say to me, "I am so happy you came to AA before you had any trouble." And I used to think, why does she think I'm here, you know? It's not like I woke up one day and thought, gee, I think I'll do AA, you know, for the rest of my life. And I mean, I'd look at these little ladies like this, and I think, man, she knew Madame Butterfly when she was a caterpillar. You know, and all the guys looked real old, you know, wore bifocals and all that stuff like that. I wear bifocals now, so somehow it's not as old, you know. I do know a story about bifocals. I know Bill wants me to tell it. This guy got his first pair of bifocals, and he wanted to try them out, you know, so he's tried them for a few days. After a few days, his wife kind of left him alone because it bothered him, you know, and now you got to have bifocals, you know. It's another milestone, right? Oh, God, I'm getting old. So after a couple of days, she said to him, "Well, how do you like your bifocals?" He said, "Pretty good, except for one thing. When I'm in the bathroom admiring the big one, the little one pees all over me." You notice it goes like a wave, right? I mean, you know, we pick up on the identification, right? That's it. Isn't the fellowship wonderful? I mean, it really is, you know. It's like the story of the guy that he and his wife retired and moved out to the country, and they decided to supplement their income by raising hogs. So they bought this sow, and they had her out in the yard over there. And every morning, the old gentleman would get up, and he'd look out the window and see if there's any little piglets. And there weren't any piglets. So after a few weeks of this, you know, he went to the vet, and he said, "I got this sow, and we want to raise some piglets, and she just doesn't seem to have any piglets." So the vet said to him, they were from the city, they didn't know. See, the vet said, "Do you have a boar?" And he said, "Well, I know." And he says, "Well, you know, you need a boar with the sow to have piglets." "Well, what am I going to do?" He said, "Well, the farmer right down the road from you, he's got a boar, so why don't you take the sow down there for some fellowship?" So he loaded the sow into the wheelbarrow and took her down there and left her all day long to fellowship with that boar, right? Brought her back that evening, and he did this for several weeks, back and forth and back and forth, still no piglets, and man, he was getting wore out. So one morning he gets up and he says to his wife, "I cannot bear to look out that window and be disappointed again. You look." And she said, "Okay, dear." And she opens the window and she looks, and he says, well? And she says, "Well, there's no piglets, but the sow's in the wheelbarrow waiting for you." I mean, there's something to fellowship now. Anyway, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 25, and I became a good, upstanding AA member. Went to meetings practically every night for about 90 days or so, and then I got well. And I got a part-time job. I worked 54 hours a week at my regular job, and now I got a part-time job working 38 hours a week. And, you know, just don't leave time for meetings. You know, I mean, when you're that busy, you got to let go of something, right? So I thought, well, I mean, you know, after all, you know, I'm the smartest person I know. I'm a legend in my own time, an undiscovered natural resource. Certainly I won't need AA now that I've learned all this. And besides, it's an Irish disease. I mean, you know, there weren't too many Chicos around there, I'll tell you that. In fact, I was the only one. So I quit going, and people came around for a while and said, "You want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "No, I'm busy. I got to go to work, or I'm tired," or, you know, whatever it was. And one fellow had said to me, "Do you have a sponsor?" I said, "Nope, I don't need a sponsor." And if you were as smart as me, you would need a sponsor. "Did you ever read the Big Book?" "Sure did." "Well, why don't you read it again?" I said, "Why? How many times do you have to read a book?" So you kind of get the picture, right? This kid was not headed to success, you know. No rocket to AA stardom here, you know. I mean, I was going this way. So eventually, you know what happened? I drank. Now, before I got to that point where I drank, something happened that could have changed my life, except it didn't. One night I was home watching TV, and my daughter, who was the youngest of the three children, had a convulsion, and she stopped breathing. And, you know, we were in a panic, and I was trying to get her to breathe. And I finally ended up out in the yard with her. I don't know why, but I ran outside with her. And I tried to give her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and I'd never done it, haven't done it since. And it seemed like every time that I would breathe in her lungs, they would expand, but every time that I would stop, she would stop. And I don't know if I could have quit trying on my own. I just kept trying and trying. And eventually her breath caught, and she started to cry. And she was like about a year and a half old at the time. Now, you would think someone was in the position that I was in, not going to meetings. But I was sober that night because I had gone to meetings. You would think that I would have stopped and thought, and I would have said, "Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. If I hadn't been sober, my child would have died. And I'm going to a meeting right now." But I didn't say or think any of that. When we're told that this is a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease, it's no lie. Because it wasn't long after that that I picked up that drink, I picked up that drug, and I was off and running again. See, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, I was a lot like you. I came here, and here were the firm handshakes, the warm smiles, people getting you coffee, people smiling at you, people saying, come back, we need you. Man, nobody had said come back to me for a long time. You know, most of my appearances were a one-time deal. I like to call that the magic of AA. Because what we all do that produces this magic of AA is what the theme of this convention is, sharing the gift. But you see, I was one of those people that went back out. And when I came back, there was a little less of the magic for me. And I went back out and I came back. And I want to tell you, during the next 4.5 years, the longest period of sobriety that I had was 3.5 weeks. And that was only once. And each time that I went out and came back, there was a little less magic. Until there was no magic at all. I remember during this period of time, there was a fellow named Chuck. He's dead now, that died sober in AA. I mean, if any of you have gone back out again, while you were out there, you know there was that one person who was the last person in the world you would ever want to run into from AA. You know the type, right? Oh, God, I didn't want to see this guy. And I'm at Winn-Dixie, checking out some groceries and a couple of six-packs of beer. And here he comes. Oh, man. He walked right up to me and he said, what are you going to do with that? The entire store had a moment of silence. I mean, the cashier was like, you know, I thought she was waiting for E.F. Hutton, man. You know, she was like this. And there he is, pointing. And I don't know what I said. What's it look like? You know, or something equally intelligent. And he said, you know what that's going to do to you? And I thought, man, this is never going to end. Just a second ago, I died, and this is hell. Oh, brother. But you know, I kept coming to AA. I mean, I come and get a white chip. Then I come back 2 days later and get one, or a week later, or 3 days. You know, I did this for 4.5 years. I'll tell you something about you guys that I noticed during this period of time. I noticed when I got my 10th white chip of the month that the applause was not as enthusiastic as I remembered it. Nobody had offered me their phone number lately either. I ended up this period of time, of course I was divorced, I'd lost everything, you know, the family, the car, the house, the whole deal, you know, alcohol's a great remover. And I ended up living in this apartment that, honest to goodness, had been chicken coops at one time, and they had kind of reconverted them for people like me. And it was kind of a neat little place, you know. I mean, the bedroom door missed a floor by about 18 inches, so if you couldn't open it or couldn't walk, at least you could get into the bedroom, right? You could kind of just slide under the door. And there was tile around the rug, but there wasn't anything under the rug that was worth mentioning. And it was this one contour couch there. Now, it didn't start out to be contour, but it had become that way over a long period of time. And that's where I spent a lot of time. And during this period of time, I decided maybe the best thing for me, you know, I listened to all the sad songs, you know, and I listened to all these others. Some of them weren't sad, but I listened to all these songs about doing away with yourself, and I thought, well, I guess I'll just have to kill myself. So, during that was 1968. During that period, there was a rock group called The Doors. I know some of you remember The Doors, right? And they had a song that was about 12 minutes long that was entitled, When the Music's Over. Remember that? When the music's over, turn out the lights. Remember that? So I figured I'd turn out my lights to Jim Morrison singing, right? Lead singer of The Doors. For those of you either too old or too young to know. And so I got my drugs, and I got my booze, and I got on my contour couch, and, you know, got everything arranged. I mean, you got to get the pillows right and everything, so when they find you, you look good, you know. And I put the record on, I lay it on the couch, and you know, did my thing and waited to, I figured when the record ended, I'd die, right? Well, the record ended and I didn't die, so I had to get up and reset it, you know? I mean, what a bummer, right? So the record kept ending and I kept staying alive. And eventually I had a convulsion, you know, and I ended up on the floor and, you know, the record's going, you know, and by this time, I was not in too good a shape, but I remember the first thing I thought of as I was laying on the floor when I could think again. And that was, if I can just get up off the floor, I'll be okay. Now, to me, that's the height of insanity, to be in the chicken coop, having fallen off the contour couch because you couldn't even die when the record ended, coming out of a convulsion and thinking, you know, it's only a minor setback. So since suicide wasn't an option, I figured homicide was. So I had made a list of all the people that I thought had harmed me. Not quite the program, but close. For some of us. And I had a double-barreled shotgun that I was going to go out and I was going to blow these people away. And I put them in order of the ones I wanted to get the most first. In case I didn't get them all, I wouldn't feel so bad. And I figured somewhere along the way, as I was going around blowing people away, the police would hear that Mad Dog Cortez was loose, and they'd come gun me down and do for me what I couldn't do for myself. The amazing thing of this is that the night before this was to happen, I ended up at the home of the man who became my first sponsor in AA. Don't know if I walked there, don't know if someone took me there, don't know if I drove there, have absolutely no idea how I got there or how I left. I just remember being there. And what I remember him saying to me is, he said to me, I don't think you're going to live much longer, but if you just try, you know, whatever happens, it's got to be better. And do you think you're willing to go to any lengths? Man, he gave me a resentment. I mean, I figured any lengths for me, you know, was swim the deepest ocean, climb the highest mountain type of thing. And he said any lengths for me was go to 5 meetings a week. So I looked at him and I said, I'll go, but I won't listen. Only in Alcoholics Anonymous does this happen. Anywhere else in the world, they'd be booting you out the door. But in AA, we know, don't we? Because we know that behind the anger and the phoniness and all the bullshit, excuse me, everybody, but that's what it really is, that's there, behind all of that is the fear and the loneliness and the pain and the hurt that we all experience. And that's what this man saw. And he said, that's okay. You don't have to listen. Just go to the meetings. So I started going to AA meetings every night. At first I didn't have a car and people would come pick me up. And I'll tell you what, when somebody didn't show up, I would call intergroup and I'd say, I'm a new alcoholic and I need a ride to a meeting. And somebody would come and get me. And I remember when I had 3 weeks sober, I tied my record. I said to my sponsor, this is the best 3 weeks I've ever had. But just to show you that I wasn't totally restored to sanity in a flash, when I was sober about 4 months or so, I remarried. Well, there was one good thing about it. We saved two other people. Also, I'll wait. Also, it was pretty obvious that I had a death wish, right? At least for me, maybe for two people. Now, to tell you that I was not well at this time would be an understatement. You know, I'll tell you a couple of examples real quick. You know, I mean, I was really sick. I, of course, didn't know that I was that sick because that was before treatment centers, and I didn't have a counselor to identify with or anything like that, you know, so I didn't know it. But there was a guy that used to go up to the Triangle Club all the time, and he only had one arm. And he borrowed $5 from me. In those days, if you borrowed my pencil, man, you better give it back. And I loaned him the $5, and he didn't pay me back. Then he'd sit up at the club there, and he'd talk about going fishing on the drift boat, going to the movies, and I would think, my $5. So finally, one day, I was honing this machete. I figured I'd go up to the Triangle Club and demand my $5, and when he gave me any lip, I'd chop his arm off, his only other arm. And someone said to me, "Have you called your sponsor?" And I said, "It's none of his business." And they said, "Are you afraid to call your sponsor?" And child psychology always works, you know. I said, "I'll show you who's afraid," so I called him. So I told him what I was about. And he had a moment of silence on the phone. And when that passed, he said to me, "Why don't you pray for him and pretend you gave him the money away?" And so I did. And you know, it worked. It really worked. It's amazing. You know, my other sponsor had said to me that he wanted me to ask for help in the morning and give thanks at night. And I said, "Well, in my case, it won't be necessary because I'm an atheist." And I'm not going to tell you what he said, but let me say this. He made it perfectly clear that I was to do that, to ask for help in the morning and give thanks at night. And I did, you know, and it's great, you know, because I'm no longer an atheist. I mean, I gave it up. There's no holidays anyway if you're an atheist, right? I remember when I was new in the program, this one person that's kind of religious in the program said to me, "Have you ever heard about Jesus?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I understand he's been extremely well adjusted for being an only child." Two atheists were marooned on an island, and they were running out of food, and they were running out of water, and they didn't know what to do. And one guy said to the other, "Man, this is really desperate. Our situation is grim. What do you think we ought to do?" And the one guy said, "I don't know. I pray if I knew how." And the other guy said, "Well, I did go to a church one time out of curiosity." And he said, "Well, why don't we do what they did? Maybe it'll work." He said, "Okay, here goes. B34, N29. I always seem to have sponsors that were big on inventories. I mean, they always had me doing these inventories and everything. I guess they thought I needed a lot of help, you know. Well, you know, kind of the way that I grew up, I told you a little bit about that. The other side of that coin was that I could never be wrong. And when I was a kid, I don't know how old I was, but I was maybe in the fourth grade. We're reading this story. As I was going to St. Ives, I met a man with 9 wives. Each wife had 9 children, and on and on and on, right? And so they asked me to read it, and I said, "As I was going to St. Louis, I met a man with 9 wives," and on, and pretty soon, you know, the teacher says, "Does anyone know what Carlos read wrong?" And this one little kid in the back goes, "I do, I do, I do." She's probably in Al-Anon today, you know. And she says,
"He said St. Louis instead of St. Ives."
And so the teacher said, "That's right, little Al-Anon, you know, or whatever." She asked me to read it again. So I got my book, and I said, "As I was going to St. Louis," she said, "How do you spell Louis?" I said, L-O-U-I-S. "How do you spell Ives?" I-V-E-S. "What does that say on the paper?" Louis. So my sponsors thought that I needed a little work with inventories. And I began to do that, you know, and work on my inventories and try to get some semblance of sanity into my life. And the amazing thing about all of this is that eventually I got involved in service. And that eventually I became, I mean, this is amazing. I know there's people in the room who remember me then. And I see Mike smiling back there, you know. We were in the lunatic fringe, Mike. You know, I became intergroup chairman in the area, and eventually I got involved in general service. And in 1979, I had the privilege of being elected delegate for South Florida to go to general service conference. And you know, this is amazing because this is the same guy now that was ripping and running and robbing people and then came to AA, a total lunatic. And you know, now 10 years later, he's going to New York with your experience, strength, and hope. You know, and you trusted me. I learned a couple things during that period of time that were really invaluable. One of them was that the experience in itself was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had. I wish I could have brought what I had back and taken it and put it into each one of your hearts, because it was just tremendous. The other thing that I learned was that the highest position we can ever attain in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober today. But that's really it. Just before I was 17 years sober, I got divorced. I asked my wife for a divorce, and now I was single and Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's another trip and another story in itself. I thought, man, you know, single and AA, oh brother. I mean, it's pretty bad when you send your picture to the Lonely Hearts Club and they mail it back and say, we're not that lonely. And after a while, I realized that, you know, this was not so great. And it wasn't a reason I got divorced, but, you know, now that I was single, it didn't take me long to figure out I didn't want to be an emotional yo-yo, you know, up and down. And, I went to the dances and all, you know, and I mean, it's, you know, the little skit we go through at the dances. Would you like to dance, you know?
Yes.
You know, and then you go out and dance, you know, and there you are planning your grandchildren, you know. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know. Two lost people hoping the other person knows which way is the exit. And then, at that point, I decided that, well, maybe what I ought to do is just, you know, go to meetings, lie about gratitude, be a chronic malcontent. I mean, you know, if I'd have been a disciple during the miracle of loaves and fishes, I probably would have said, oh, brother, leftovers for 6 weeks, you know. So I had figured out that I was probably going to never get married again and that, you know, that's the way it was going to be. I'd just go to meetings and, you know, do what we do at meetings, share experience, strength, and hope. And there's a story by a man called William Coppers, who was not an alcoholic as far as I know, but he did go through a pretty bad time. And what happened was he decided he was going to commit suicide. And it was in London at turn of the century. And he got a cab, and the cab took him to the Thames River, where he was going to fling himself into the river and drown. And before he got into the cab, he'd already tried suicide twice. He had thrown himself on a knife that he had wedged in the cracks in the boards of the floor of his house, and the knife blade broke. And he tried to hang himself by putting a rope around his neck and tying it to the rafters and jumping off a chair, and the rope broke. So he was kind of desperate. On the way to the Thames River, the fog came in, and river, and he finally said, never mind, I'll find it myself. And he got out of the cab. As he was groping from door to door, he tripped over a doorstep, and when he looked, it was his own. And he went inside, and he wrote these words, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. And it was just about that time, God moving in his mysterious ways, that I was at a meeting one night, and this girl came in, and I certainly had never seen her before. And she had celebrated her year. So, of course, after the meeting, I went and did the proper program thing and said, can I have a hug? Wasn't a chronic malcontent that night, I'll tell you. And we talked for a long time until some ingrate in the room started flicking the lights on and off. And I said, well, she invited me to her home group, which was True Hope, as was mentioned. And I said, well, maybe I'll go, you know, being cool, right? And then she walked away. And I thought, my. So the following Tuesday, that was the meeting she invited me to, Tuesday, I went to True Hope, you know, spent about 3 hours getting ready, which made me an hour early. Now I had to ride around for an hour and listen to my head, which is never good, only to go to the meeting and sit there. I know there's people here that were there at that time that remember. So we could sit at the meeting, and I could look at her, but if she looked at me, I kind of smile and look away, and she'd do the same, you know, if she was looking at me. And everybody in the group kind of watched this sketch that was going on at the meeting and kind of went like that. One night, I asked her to go to a dance, and her sponsor and her friends at it, like I just said, do you want to go to hell tonight? You know, I mean, you know, it was unbelievable. And then she invited me to go to High Lie, because she had been married to a gambler, and she wanted to know if I gambled. And when she found out I was bored out of my skull, she figured, well, that's a plus, you know. So we had this AA courtship. You know, AA courtship, you go to the meeting, you meet at the meeting. Would you like to go to Denny's tonight? And we'd go to Denny's, you know, and talk for 3 hours, which meant then I would go home and stay up another 3 hours going over the conversation that I had. And when she said this, I should have said that. Well, what did she mean about that? Did that mean this? You know how we do, right? And get about an hour sleep and wake up. And I mean, I was like ready to go, right? And finally, I said to her one day, I said, you know, something very strange going on. I must have some kind of a flu or some mysterious malady. I don't seem to be able to eat. I have no appetite. I don't seem to be able to sleep. And she said, you know, now that you mention it, the same thing's been happening to me. Isn't that strange? We didn't know, right? Well, before we ever even held hands, I knew that this was who I wanted to marry. And I'll tell you why. Not because I was impulsive, but because we had sat and we had talked about every single thing that you could possibly talk about. We talked about children, grandchildren, because we had grandchildren. We talked about likes, dislikes, housing, architecture, foods, travel, religion, everything. And we got to be friends. We learned the difference between being in love and being in heat. And we kept it at that level. Friends, you know, when you've been burned a few times, you know, you get a little nervous. And so that's why I say I knew I wanted to marry her before we had ever even held hands. I just didn't know how to ask her. You know, not an easy thing to do, guys. So eventually we were at Denny's one night. I met her there at 11:30. I mean, where else, right? Denny's. I met her at 11:30. She had been talking to someone she sponsored, and we met, and we talked and talked and talked and talked, and, you know, it was like 3 in the morning. We're still there, you know. Our kidneys are exploding from tea and Pepsis and coffee. She figured that I was going to say to her, I don't think anymore. And she was thinking, this guy has the strangest way of dumping somebody. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to say, you know, propose to her. So eventually she said, well, we both have to get up and go to work in the morning. We better go. Yeah, you're right. We better. Nothing said, right? So we go out and walk out in the parking lot, walk to the car, and I said, can we sit in your car and talk for a minute? And the amazing thing is she said, yeah, okay, you know. So we sat in the car and we talked a little longer. And finally I said, look, what I want to say is I want you to think about us being married. And she said, oh, I could do that. And I said, well, not a commitment there, right? And I said, well, I mean, will you marry me? Could you marry me? Can you marry me? I mean, I didn't know what to say. And then she did this. All you guys are going to understand this. She looked down at her hands for about 300 years and finally said, yes, I'll marry you. So we planned our wedding. You know, a lot of people, Bill was at the wedding, and there was a lot of people in the program that came to the wedding, and we had our whole wedding planned, and we got married in the church that I attended. And you know, it was just wonderful. And then we were going to the dances, and a couple weeks before we got married, we were at this one dance, and I want to tell you this one thing before we get into that, because it has to do with it. When I was real new in AA, I had been working in a furniture store one time, and I had seen this painting, the only time I ever felt this way about anything or anyone, and then I'm getting to what I'm going to tell her, but there was this painting of this woman there, and I was just taken by it. The outline of New York, you know, skyline of New York was in the background and all that. And, I mean, I was just so taken by this painting, I wanted to, you know, throw my tools on the floor and go to New York and go see if this person really existed. It was the most tremendous emotion I ever experienced in my life. So we're coming back from a dance about 2 weeks before we're married, and I thought of it. And I thought, well, I'm going to tell her. So I said to her, you know, I only felt the way that I feel about you one other time in my life. And I'm telling her about this painting with this woman in the painting, and I'm describing the painting to her and all this, you know. Kind of saying, why don't you just shut up, you know. But the mouth kept going, right, and I'm telling her all about it and describing it. And she gets quiet. And eventually she says, my God, I posed for that painting 22 years ago. I want you to meet the woman in the portrait, my wife, Beverly. Would you stand up, please? Now, if you're still skeptical about God, maybe that'll help. But I'll tell you, we went, I went to this meeting 1 hour before intergroup, and she was the intergroup representative, which means she was going out as I was going in. I never saw her. Our kids went to the same school. We bought gas at the same gas station, ate at the same restaurant, shopped at the same stores, lived within a few miles of each other. She even worked at one time for the lady who lived next door to my aunt, and we never met until I believe was the right time. Not only that, but last year, my wife found out who her real father is and found out her real father is Puerto Rican. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. And what we have to share is a very precious gift. It's a gift that no one else in this world can share like we can. One drunk, eye to eye, sharing their life and their heart and everything they have with this other person. That's what makes the difference between us making it and not making it sometimes. To be able to do that. To be able to share like that. There was a man that had gotten a call to be a missionary, and he and his wife moved to Africa. And they wanted to be missionaries in an area where there had never been missionaries before. And they built a little house there, and the people in the village were friendly and all that. But he could never quite get to them. You know, never quite, you know that feeling when you know you really got to someone and you got that bond, right? He could never achieve that. And after 5 or 6 years, their little boy that was born there died of some jungle malady or other. And the family was just totally overcome. And the father had taken the little boy, and they buried him under a tree in the bush. And the village blacksmith had gone with them to help him dig the grave. And he dug the grave and buried the little boy, and this boy's father just couldn't take it anymore. And he started sobbing and crying. And the blacksmith looked at him, and he looked at him. And he jumped up and he started running to the village shouting. And you know what he shouted? He shouted, "The white man, he cries, he cries." Because you see, he had shared the gospel, and he had shared his medical knowledge, and he had shared a lot of things, but he had not shared his emotions. And isn't that what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work? That we share what's on the inside. Isn't that what makes it possible for all of us to be here sober today? That someone shared their insides with us. Beverly and I have 5 children between us, and we're going to have our 7th grandchild soon. And none of this would be possible if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, just none of it would, you know. We have children that we actually have a relationship with, that we talk to. We have a son that's in NA. He's got 3.5 years clean. And also have one that's still out there. Hopefully he'll get here one day. And my mother, who's 88 years old, who is now no longer able to take care of herself, has now had to come to live with us. In God's love, wouldn't be there to allow me, because my wife does an exemplary job with my mother, but to allow me to be able to have her there, because we were never friends, her and I. You know, she always did the things that annoyed me, and I guess I did the things that annoyed her, but we were never friends. But, you know, she's in our home, and we're able to provide a home for her. And I can say what I didn't say that night. When my daughter didn't die, I can say, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm sober today and that I can do that. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous that AA has taught me how to be a friend, has taught me how to be a father and a husband and a son and a citizen, and all the things that all the roles that we play in life. Because none of it would have happened without you. I sang all those sad songs back years ago, but now I sing a new song, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know you sing it too. Because you see, we've all walked through the valley of the shadow of death, and today we have no evil to fear whatsoever, because God is with us. And hand in hand, you and I will continue to trudge this road to happy destiny, singing a new song called Alcoholics Anonymous. Enjoy the convention, and God bless you.